It's a little bit difficult to think of any one subject which seems to be less suitable for a Swanwick than a study of the Book of Job. If I add to that the fact that I didn't choose it, you can see that I'm disclaiming all responsibility only to take it up again, because actually I don't believe this at all. It's a most suitable subject if we will look at it rightly. But you see, the average age in this room, I suppose, is somewhere around about 20, 21, 22. And the average age of those who assembled together to discuss Job's problem, I don't know. But Job lived to the age of something over the 200 mark, as far as we can tell. He lived 140 years after his tribulation. At the time when discussion was going on between himself and his friends, one of them could say, "With us are old and very learned men, much elder than thy father," which suggests that there was somebody already well up in the 200s at the time when the discussion was taking place. And on the whole setting of this discussion is a very learned assembly of what we would regard as being extremely ancient individuals. Not only so. Not only is the average age of those in this room only in the early 20s at the latest, the average degree of health, if you can assess that in figures, is very high. Most of us are alert, alive, physically in good trim, capable of taking on anyone one likes in minor athletics and getting away with it. But in the company of Job, well, I don't suppose that his friends, who included some much older than his father, had recently been engaged in anything very strenuous in the way of physical activity. And as to Job himself, well, he'd fallen upon very hard times. As we meet him, he is squatted upon the ground. He is afflicted with a grievous skin disorder which requires him to gain even the slightest relief to scrape his flesh with bits of broken pot. He is deprived of his property, of his children, and apparently of the affections of his wife. His friends have all left him. He is an outcast, full of woes, with nothing, it seems, to relieve his existence at all, save three people whose way of giving him consolation was so ineffectual that they have gone down into history under the name of Job's comforters. And we know, those of us who know that expression, what a Job's comforter is. It arises from the expression of Job himself in discussing their efforts to solace him: "Miserable comforters are ye all," for this is what they were. Now, it's nevertheless not untimely for us to give attention to this. Even in this room, there are those whose state of health is not quite like the average. There are here some who have come because, despite many afflictions, they have, with the assistance of their brethren and sisters, been brought and are enabled to enjoy some of the experience of this assembly of young and healthy people in circumstances which would not be of their choosing, but which they bear patiently and happily. And in this company, I would imagine, there are very few exceptions to the rule that tomorrow we shall be a day older. And moreover, in 10 years' time, if we are still here, we will be 10 years older. There are in this room those who are well above the average of age, and despite their sprightliness, which belies the greyness of their hair, nevertheless are very much older than they used to be when Swanwick first started. And I suppose there will be some in this room who will confess that their health is not quite what it was. There may even be some who from time to time have been stricken down with an infirmity all unsuspected, which has reduced them to impotence and perhaps to agony. Certainly if they are not here, they are elsewhere. There may even be some who thought they were prosperous and have been smitten by a freak of circumstances which reduced them to poverty. And again, if they are not here, they are elsewhere. And there is over all of us the eminently likely possibility that, should the Lord's coming not occur within a relatively short time, then quite a number of us may find ourselves in circumstances capable of comparison with this calamity that fell so suddenly and deprived Job of everything that life offered most dear. So rejoice by all means, O young man, in thy youth, and certainly rejoice, O young maiden, in thine, but let us bear in mind that there are not, as it were, three species of human beings: the young, who will always be young; the middle-aged, who have never been anything else; and the old, who are about to leave us. This this is not three distinct species of mankind, but is a stage of gradation from one through the second and to the third and beyond. So it won't do us any harm to remember in the days of our youth not only our Creator, but also the possibility that the very desirable situation in which we find ourselves will not invariably persist. Of course, there are those who remind us of this. We are not uncommonly told that it is possible by the use of this cream or that lotion or the other treatment to disguise from the world the fact that we have already had 7 21st birthdays. The attempt to make ourselves the kind of people who belie our age to the world, with which I have very much sympathy and with which deceit I have sometimes connived, and will yet do so if I saw any chance of it, is a thing which I think we can understand, but it doesn't really help us to solve problems. It merely covers them over, and things which are covered over and can't get at the air are rather apt to go bad underneath. So we have to bear in mind that we would do well rather to recognise facts than to blink them, even though we are in good condition at the moment, most of us. Now, the book of Job and his friends. Who was Job? Who were his friends? Where did they live? How long ago? And what happened? Well, that would take us a long time to give a final answer to, and I don't think, after half a long time, we would be anywhere near finality. But we can at least begin to think of some of the things involved. So let's turn to Job chapter 1, shall we, and see where it takes us. Job chapter 1, verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she-asses and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the children of the East. 3 verses of very circumstantial details about somebody who is given all the marks of having been somebody quite real. There was a man. Now that in itself isn't quite conclusive, because we have in the words of the Lord Jesus statements like, there was a certain rich man which fared sumptuously every day. And we don't from those words conclude that the Lord Jesus had a particular rich man to whom he could have given a name in mind, though perhaps he could. There may actually have been examples of that kind around. But that this is the kind of people whom life is made up of. There are men of that kind, rich, who fare sumptuously every day. So there was a man could only have been the introduction to a parable. It doesn't necessarily show that there was such a person. However, in the land of Uz takes us a little further. For in the land of Uz certainly does seem to be linked up with specific places and perhaps specific people in the Bible, as you will see if you make your first cross-reference to Jeremiah chapter 25. Jeremiah chapter 25. We really need to begin at verse 15, but I think we can take it up at verse 19, where Jeremiah is asked to offer a cup of the fury of the Lord unto many nations, and verse 19 says, to Pharaoh king of Egypt and his servants and his princes and all his people, and all the mingled people, and all the kings of the land of Uz, and all the kings of the land of the Philistines, and Ascalon and Gaza and Ekron and the remnant of Ashdod, Edom and Moab, and so forth. A large number of bodies of people are mentioned there, included in a historical survey being the land of Uz. And while we're near Jeremiah, let's turn to his Lamentations in chapter 4. Lamentations chapter 4. Verse 21. At the destruction of Jerusalem, rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, that dwellest in the land of Uz. The cup shall pass through unto thee also, and thou shalt be drunken, and make thyself naked. Jeremiah here obviously referring to his own earlier prophecy as to what was to happen to these people. And the linking in verse 21 of Lamentations 4 of the land of Uz with Edom that dwells there strongly suggests that this is an Edomite background. And if you care to look in the book of Genesis, you will find, in connection with the same circumstances and the same geographical location, that there was a certain man who had those two famous children called Uz and Buz, which always waken a little bit of a smile when we read that section of the book of Genesis. So the man lived in the land of Uz and appears to have been closely linked with the Edomites. Now, in addition to that, we can go a little bit further, because when we come to the story of Job's misfortunes in chapter 1, verse 13, we have mentioned the Sabaeans fell upon those who looked after your oxen and your asses, and in verse 17, the Chaldeans made out three bands and fell upon Job's camels. So, two particular tribes of people, the Sabaeans and the Chaldeans, all hailing from districts to the east of Palestine, again seem to give us a geographical location. Nor yet that, only. Chapter 2, verse 11. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, and they made an appointment together to come to bemoan him and to comfort him. And just as Job is given a name, so are his three friends given names. And just as the place where Job was from or in is mentioned, so is some association of these three people mentioned as well. We have Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. Now, perhaps we can't identify those exactly, but, well, let's turn to Genesis chapter 36 and see some links. Genesis chapter 36, quite close to the beginning of the chapter. In fact, we'll read verse 1 to get the connection for ourselves. 36:1, these are the generations of Esau, the same as Edom. Esau took his wives, the daughters of Canaan, Adah the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Aholibamah the daughter of Arnah, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite, and Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebaioth. And Adah bare to Esau Eliphaz. Eliphaz, therefore, was a son, that is to say, some Eliphaz, not necessarily the same Eliphaz, was a son of Esau. Now, in the same chapter of Genesis, we find a little later down that Eliphaz himself had a son called Teman, verse 11 of the same chapter. And the sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, and Gartam, and Kenaz. So, amongst the children of Edom, there was a man called Eliphaz who had a son called Teman. And in Job chapter 2, we have Eliphaz the Temanite mentioned. Now, I know they're the wrong way round. In the Genesis 36 record, you would speak of Teman the Eliphazite, wouldn't you? Because Teman was Eliphaz's son. Whereas in Job, we have Eliphaz the Temanite. But this doesn't greatly matter, because if it was about that time, and if either of them was the person referred to in Genesis, either Eliphaz or Teman, we only have to suppose, as did happen on one occasion, that a man called his country or his city by the name of his son or something of that kind, and then Eliphaz the second, grandson of Eliphaz the first, could still be called Eliphaz the Temanite, if that was the way it worked. Now, I'm not going to attempt to identify him any further than that, I don't think there's any need to, but it does show that we have an Edomite background and apparently an approximately patriarchal setting, not too far away from the time of Abraham or a generation or two later, as a possible setting for Eliphaz. While we were in Genesis chapter 36, by the way, did you notice in verse 11, somebody called Zepho, Z-E-P-H-O in our version, and I just wonder whether that could have been in any way related to Zophar, the Naamathite, of Job chapter 2. Whether it is or it isn't, we've got a link of the right kind. Now, Bildad the Shuhite, too, is linked with characters of the book of Genesis, because Shuah is closely bound up with the history of Isaac and of Judah in particular, though the actual references to that we don't need to turn up at this moment. Roughly speaking, therefore, we have these things. We have names that smack of the times of Abraham or a couple of generations later. We have a location that seems to be linked south and east of Palestine, in the neighbourhood of Edom and Moab. And we have people living in circumstances that fit in very well with the keepers of flocks and herds in the sort of way that Jacob himself did when he was enriched in the land of Laban and returned from Syria to Palestine. very definitely patriarchal in their background. Now, there's more than that to it, and this is quite an interesting thing. I think it might be useful if you took some notes of these figures, which I've obtained at second hand, which are very interesting. They concern the names of God in the book of Job. Now, there are six names used for God in the book of Job, and they are these. In the English word spelling, they are El, that's simply E-L, Eloah, E-L-O-A-H, Elohim, E-L-O-H-I-M, Adonai, A-D-O-N-A-I, and then that name, the correct pronunciation of which is a matter of so much dispute, but which is commonly in these days described in our midst as Yahweh, and which has the four Hebrew consonants YHWH beyond doubt in its spelling, and Shaddai, the last one, SHADDAI. Now, having given you those six, these are the number of times that they occur in the book of Job. El, 51. Eloah, 39. Elohim, 17. Adonai, 1. Yahweh, 31. Shaddai, 31. Now, there's nothing very extraordinary about those figures until you compare them with the rest of Scripture. When you compare them with the rest of Scripture, some rather remarkable things emerge. For example, the word Eloah only occurs 57 times in the whole Bible. Job has about 70% of them. The name Elohim, on the other hand, must occur thousands of times, at least 2,500 in the Bible. And yet the book of Job uses it really quite rarely by comparison. The name Adonai occurs perhaps 8,000 times in the Bible, and Job uses it once. The name Yahweh, well, at least 7,000 times, and Job uses it only 31 times, less frequently than Elohim, than Eloah, and El, and only as frequently as Shaddai. And Shaddai occurs only 48 times in the Bible, and Job has 60% of them. A very remarkable distribution, therefore, of the names of God. Now, we could draw a great many conclusions from that, but what I want to point out is this. Take the name YHWH, the covenant name of God. Although it occurs 31 times in the book of Job, the speakers only use it once. And that's Job. Just on one occasion, that word is used by Job. All the other 30 times are compressed into the narrative at the beginning and the narrative at the end. They're the writer's use of the word and not the speaker's uses. And again, the word Shaddai, although this is used very frequently in the book of Job, relatively speaking, in the rest of the Bible, of the remaining 17 occurrences, 9 of them are in the first 3 books of the Bible. First 4 books, I'm sorry. Now, what all this very clearly points out, I think, is that the language of the book of Job in relation to God is very closely linked up with the times of Abraham and thereabouts, in a way that is untrue of almost any other book of the Bible except the first 5 books themselves. You may remember in the book of Exodus that when God was speaking to Moses, he said that he appeared unto the fathers by the name of Shaddai, God Almighty, as we have it in our Bible. But by his name, Jehovah, or Yahweh, he was not known unto them. And it certainly seems in the record of the book of Genesis that this name of God was specially revealed as a name authorized for use thenceforward to Moses, and had only rarely been used by Moses in his narrative, putting it appropriately into the words of the previous speakers before that time. Now, Job appears to be against a background where the name Jehovah had not become common. The narrator uses it. If he were living in Moses' time, he would be entitled to use it. But the speakers themselves do not, except just on one occasion, where Job himself employs it. And again, the name Shaddai, whatever that name may be supposed to mean, is almost peculiar to the book of Job and the first 5 books of the Bible. and Job uses it very frequently, again seeming to point out that he belongs to a time where this was the recognized, authorized, and proper name whereby you describe God. So, taking all these things together, it seems to me that what we have concluded is that the people in the book of Job are very probably real people living in the times not much later than Abraham, that the land of the book of Job is that land which we think of now as being Edom and thereabouts, and that the time of the book of Job is again linked with Abrahamic times, or a little later, by the names of God which are employed. Now, Job himself I haven't said anything about. There's a temptation to find Job too in the rest of the Bible. There's almost a possibility that we might do so, for in the book of Job itself, the name Job is not occurring in the Bible as we have it in our King James Version for the first time. It's found at least twice in the book of Genesis. Once amongst the sons of Issachar, and a second, somewhat varied, its name is Jobab now, amongst the dukes of the house of Edom. These also you can turn up by reference to a concordance. Now, I'm not going to press this too far. In the first place, unfortunately, the spelling isn't quite the same in either case. If I can put it like this, the word Job, as we render it, would, I suppose, if you tried to render the Hebrew exactly, be something like Eob, with two vowels in it. E-ob. The word Job, the son of Issachar, is a simple Yob, a one-syllable word, without the first consonant. The word Jobab is much more like the Issachar son. It's Jobab, not Eobab. And if it weren't for the fact that the Hebrew does sometimes miss out this aleph when it's not really needed, I would say that this identification would fall down on that account. As it is, I think it could still just be possibly true. If it is, it's rather interesting, because Jobab, or the house of Edom, was again belonging to the right generation, and he was a prince there and reigned as a king in the country, and there's some evidence that Job himself in the book did the same. Now, with that, I'm going to leave the attempt to identify the people. Now, what about the circumstances? Well, first of all, let's classify the book of Job in our own minds, which is not very difficult to do. To get an idea of the structure of Job is about the simplest possible thing, and 5 minutes patient attention can cause you to learn it off by heart. That might be a famous last word, but I'm going to try now. This is the structure of the book of Job. Prologue, chapters 1 and 2. Now, without identifying the chapters, the following speeches in the following order. Job. Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job, Zophar, Job, Eliphaz 2, Job, Bildad 2, Job, Zophar 2, Job, Eliphaz 3, Job, Bildad 3, Job, and no, not what you thought. Elihu. Elihu. God. Job. God. Job. And then a final piece of narrative in which the words of God are again brought before us. Now you see how what a very simple structure that is. You have a prologue in which certain historical events are recorded. Then you have a series of cycles of speeches in which Job Eliphaz, Job Bildad, Job Zophar is repeated twice and gets well on the way a third time until after Job Eliphaz, Job Bildad, Job makes what looks like a long speech in the version as we have it before us, and Zophar doesn't come into the picture again. There are some people, by the way, who think that he does. That there has been some form of slight scribal error in the book of Job, and that actually Job's long last speech could best be split up, and one piece in the middle given to Zophar, whose originally it was. They say, when doing this, that there's part of Job's speech that doesn't sound like Job at all, which almost seems to be going back on what Job had said before, and that fits in very well with what Zophar said. Personally, I don't think this is so. I've been through it fairly carefully, and it seems to me that it can reasonably harmonize with the kind of thing Job is saying, that it doesn't fit in at all with what Zophar would have said. So I would think we have it right. Then after those three cycles, the third one incomplete, finishing, you remember, Job, Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job. We have a young man in the picture, Elihu, at least relatively young, because he keeps silence until the older men have spoken, a long speech by him, and then the final discussion between the Almighty himself with a long speech, divided into two parts, by a brief ejaculation from Job, a short reply by Job, and the epilogue that takes us to the final piece of history. Now, that's what the book looks like, simply as a matter of counting the chapters and giving them to the various speakers. Now, it's a bigger problem than that, of course. What kind of a book is this book? What kind of a book is a book in which four men can sit down on the ground and speak in strict circulation? Job, Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job, Zophar. In what I imagine will be judged to be excellent poetic style. Waiting patiently for each other, accepting their order, not jumping out of their turn, but taking their opportunities as they come to them in strict cycle and waiting until they come. Let's take any four enthusiastic people in this room, let us imagine we were doing so, and put them on four chairs for comfort's sake, and leave out the causes of exasperation which were so common in the book of Job, and have them all in good health, and set them in discussion about something that they feel very deeply about, and what kind of a chance do you think we would have? That A, B, A, C, A, D. A, B, A, C, A, D. A, B, A, C. As far as that, could go on without somebody interrupting. I would say that the chances are zero. It doesn't work out that way. Even with a chairman, it would be difficult for it to work out that way. But a chairman would be absolutely essential. But in the book of Job, it isn't at all like that. They wait upon each other and they engage in patient waiting for their turn. They're very rude to each other sometimes when their turn does come, but they can bottle up their rudeness until the time arrives. Now, it seems to me that we have in a book that's organized in that way, something which is quite outside the ordinary run of the kind of discussions we're used to. What then has been happening? Well, it isn't quite as easy as that either. There are worse problems than that. Look at what happens when Job is afflicted in chapter 1. Job chapter 1. The verses we read before about the people coming with tidings of woe. Verse 13. And it fell on a day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, that there came a messenger unto Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, the fire of God is fallen from heaven and has burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another, and said, the Chaldeans made three bands, and fell upon the camels, and have taken them away, yea, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another, and said, thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness, and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. Now, picture exactly what that would mean if we imagine it being enacted in front of us. We would have Job seated here as it might be on this platform. As he sat there, someone would come to him and say, Job, your asses and your oxen have all been taken, and all your servants looking after them have been killed, except me. And before he's finished his words, there comes in somebody else, and that servant stands on one side, and the next servant comes and says, Job, fire has come down from heaven and destroyed all your sheep, and the servants who looked after them are all gone, except me. And while he is speaking, the third man comes in, and the second goes to one side, and the third man speaks and says, Job, the Chaldeans have come, and they've taken all your camels, and they've slain all the servants who are looking after those, except me. And while he is still speaking, a fourth comes in, and he no doubt steps on one side and joins the three who have spoken their message, And the fourth one comes and says, Job, your sons and your daughters were having a feast in the house of the eldest one, and a wind came and blew the house down on top of them, and they all perished with the servants who were looking after them, except me. Now, as I pictured it, I don't know what's been going on in your minds, but I hope you've actually seen those four servants coming along and offering a message and going to the other side and lining up. And you've seen it. And this seems to me to be a very important ingredient in our attempt to understand how the book of Job is arranged for us. It's arranged, I'm quite sure, for an audience. We are in this book given Job in front of our eyes. We are in this book given a series of messengers coming with messages of woe, one hard upon the heels of the one before him, and the next hard upon his heels, and so forth. Each saying what has happened, and then waiting until the combined effect of the dreadful calamity is borne in upon Job, and he arises and rends his mantle and shaves his head and falls down upon the ground and worships and says, Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, I've pictured you a dramatic scene, haven't I? I've drawn in front of you, however ineffectually, something which could have been enacted in front of you. We could have had four young men from the audience come and say that, and bring the message, and stand on one side. And I think we did when the book of Job was presented to the people who learned its message. There's all the ingredients of something having been arranged for some form of public presentation, or at least for some form of imaginative public reading here. Now, in the 20th century, we are so accustomed to what are called visual aids, of whatever kind, that we shall very shortly be able to understand anything unless there is a picture in front of our eyes. We are getting to the stage where visual aids are becoming absolutely essential before we believe our own ears. We are almost at the point where we can't understand with one of our senses at once, but we'll have to have two. Working from the cartoons through the televisions, through the new methods of instruction in schools, visual aids are essential. But I think the Oriental imagination was better than that. So was, I believe, the Victorian one. I'm not sure the Georgian one, meaning George VI, wasn't either. I suspect that the ability to imagine pictures is being robbed from us by the constant urge that we must have real pictures in front of our eyes. Now, I don't actually think this is really quite as necessary as some people make it out to be. I think it's still perfectly possible to see a thing going on in your mind's eye if the thing is suitably presented. And I would say that almost certainly never has been anybody who has read the book of Job with intelligence and with sympathy who hasn't seen this picture there, of Job waiting and messengers coming in one by one, giving him their news and passing on, and Job himself breaking down under the combined impact of this report of the calamities that had overtaken him, all unawares as he was, all basking in this security. I suppose, actually, the Job who was greeted by these four messengers when they came would have been sitting on, well, if not on a throne, at least on a very comfortable chair. Up to that point, he was a very well-off Job. He was Job who had lack of nothing, with a happy family, at least with a family which he did his utmost to make happy, and with circumstances all conspiring in his favour, and one by one the messengers come and say, this has been taken away, and this, and this, and this. Now take the stage of drama a little further, because it seems to me this is impressed upon us more and more as the book is opened up. I've really not taken the thing in sequence so far. We've come somewhat in the middle and found Job suddenly being deprived of his wealth and his property, and later of his health, and almost of his life. The book doesn't quite begin like that. Having given to us a picture of Job's riches, we are then told, verse 4 of chapter 1, And Job's sons went and held a feast at the house of each one upon his day. And they sent and called for their three sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, It may be that my sons have sinned and renounced God in their hearts. Thus did Job continually. Just a little aside here. So far as I can see, when we're thinking about the book of Job, we very rarely think about his children. Of course, there isn't much said about them. We meet them in chapter 1, and they're dead by the end of the chapter. And at the end of the book, although Job has children again, they appear to be children in a new lease of life that are granted to Job in restitution for the loss which he had at the beginning of his life. But it's a rather interesting thing, isn't it, that this man who was perfect and upright, that feared God and eschewed evil, should have, according to the record, 7 sons and 3 daughters, who seem to have spent most of their time in diurnal feasts. It doesn't actually say they feasted every day, going through the houses in rotation. It does say they feasted in the house of each one, everyone on his day. And whether this means his birthday or something of that kind, I don't know. But at least they should have gone in for feasting quite a lot. And when Job, when any one of their feast was over, sent and took them and sanctified them and said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." I think we would say, it may very well be, if they were living that kind of life, that they had done that kind of thing. Against their character, nothing is said. We know little about them, but, well, we do remember Eli, who was a faithful and good high priest, but whose sons Hophni and Phinehas certainly did not walk in his ways. And although Eli was good, he was blamed for the misbehavior of his sons, and his sons were slain upon the field of battle. We do remember Samuel, an excellent judge of Israel, and although we know nothing about the manner in which he was engaged in the upbringing of his family, we do know that at the time when Samuel was growing old, the people could come to Samuel and say, "Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways." And whether they had the picture correctly, or they were just using this as an excuse to get themselves the king they were wanting, I don't know. But at least there is a picture there of the children of Samuel not living according to their father's habits. And in the book of Job, when Job himself is called perfect and upright, and we are told that his children appear to engage in a constant activity of feasting and wine drinking, which suggests that these were not necessarily very sober assemblies, it does look a little as though, possibly through no fault of Job's, the family with which he was associated was a family whose behaviour couldn't exactly match his own. What the reason for this may have been, we're not told. But in an assembly of this kind, which is already being commiserated with, on having to sit in the company of a man of 100 or so, with people much older than his father around him, for the space of 2 longish sessions this morning, and imagine themselves doing their many cycles of discussion when they were engaged in considering Job's problem, it is worthwhile bearing in mind that there were some young people about as well, and they had a much better time. They used everyone on his day to go into the appropriate house and have a good feast with plenty of wine, and well, it's a pity that it was all cut short by the house falling on top of them, isn't it? And possibly, therefore, there might even be, in the book of Job, some form of message to us that the tedium of listening to the old people carries with it more eternal profit than the constant round of convivial rotation from one house to another in which the sons and the daughters of Job were engaged. They were simply people who lived, it seems, as the beasts that perished, and we hear no more about them. Whereas the latter end of Job was really a latter end of himself. He came to good in the end. They pass out of our recollection. However, that was an aside, so we'll go on with Job. Verse 6. "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before God, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, Whence comest thou? And Satan answered the Lord, and said, From going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, Hast thou considered my servant Job? For there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, Doth Job fear God for naught? Hast thou not made an hedge about him and about his house and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth thine hand now and touch all that he hath, and he will renounce thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, all that he has is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord." There was a regular assembly of exalted personages. They came together and presented themselves before God. And they are called in the main the sons of God, but in their company there comes one called the Satan. With minds conditioned to what people tend to say about Satan, it is not unnatural that we should look at this chapter with minds either wanting to find that kind of Satan there, if we belong to that group of people, or with minds defensively orientated trying to find him not there, if we belong to their opponents. Now, the kind of people who believe in the Satan we are disputing would say, as you know well, that there was a time when amongst God's mighty angels there was one called Lucifer, greater and more exalted than them all, whose pride caused him to seek rebellion against God, because of which he fell down to the earth, expelled by God, and became the fallen angel, the enemy, the Satan. And then it was this one who harboured evil designs in his heart against the plans of God and the character of Job, and therefore caused Job to be afflicted in the way these chapters bring out. In their favour can be said that he did speak evil against Job, a sort of evil at all events, that he did cause afflictions to be brought upon him, and that Job suffered very grievously because of the activities of this one. Almost nothing else in the record, however, corresponds to that kind of Satan. The Satan who is given to us here is apparently quite at home in the divine courts. He comes and goes as he will. God addresses him in terms of politeness and not of friendship. From whence comest thou? From going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it. A perfectly friendly discussion about the character of Job takes place between them. God mentions his righteousness. Satan offers an explanation of it, which is not entirely to Job's credit. He seeks license to bring afflictions upon Job that will put his integrity to the test, and is granted that license. And Job is afflicted with God's full consent. That isn't the little bit like that embittered enemy of God whom the devil of popular theology is supposed to be. The whole terms of the discussion, the friendliness between the two principal parties, and the manner in which God allows the affliction which is imposed upon Job, is in no way like the Satan whom we are asked to believe in. That says what it isn't like, without saying what it is. The same is true in the next chapter as well, when this Satan is given license to take everything away from Job except the bare remnants of his life. And once again, it's done by God's consent. Not only so, when the chapters open up and Job discusses with his friends what has gone wrong with him, Job takes it for granted that God has afflicted him. The friends take it for granted that God has afflicted him. God never denies this. And Satan, having come into chapter 1, disappears completely after chapter 2, and we never meet him again. When the situation is summed up in chapter 42, we have Job commended after his penitence. We have the three friends rebuked, and we have Satan entirely forgotten. He does his job in chapters 1 and 2, and then he disappears. Now, we can go further than this, because there are a couple of parallels which are worth drawing. First of all, turn to the book of Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 3, verse 1. And the angel showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to be his adversary. And the Lord said unto Satan, The Lord rebuked thee, O Satan. Yea, the Lord which hath chosen Jerusalem rebuked thee. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire? Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and stood before the angel, and he answered and spake unto him, and spake unto those that stood before him, saying, Take the filthy garments from off him. And unto him he said, Behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with rich apparel. And I said, Let them set a fair mitre upon his head. And so forth. We have again a heavenly court. We have again the Satan there. We have again a man under accusation. And we have the situation discussed as to whether this man is guilty of the things alleged against him and worthy of the debasement which has come upon him, or whether he is not. And after the discussion, he is vindicated and given his righteousness and his purity back. Not parallel exactly with the Job record, but sufficiently parallel to be worthwhile drawing into the picture. Now the other one is of another kind, and this time we must turn to the book of Kings. So the Book of Kings I'm hunting around for this. Oh yes, 1 Kings chapter 22. 1 Kings 22. This is the story of a wicked king of Israel who wishes to apply to his false prophets for confirmation of his intention to engage in warfare. When he is invited to try instead a prophet of the Lord, then this is what occurs. Verse 14. And Micaiah the prophet of the Lord said, As the Lord liveth, what the Lord saith unto me, that will I speak. And when he was come to the king said unto him, Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we forbear? And he answered, Go up and prosper, and the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king. And the king said unto him, How many times shall I adjure thee that thou speak unto me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord? And he said, I saw all Israel scattered upon the mountains, as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Lord said, These have no master, let them return every man to his house in peace. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, Did I not tell thee he would not prophesy concerning me good, but evil? And he said, this is Micaiah said, Therefore hear thou the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing by him, on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, Who shall entice Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said on this manner, and another said on that manner. And there came forth a spirit and stood before the Lord and said, I will entice him. And the Lord said unto him, Wherewith? And he said, I will go forth, and I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And he said, Thou shalt entice him, and shalt prevail also. Now therefore go forth and do so. Now that's a heavenly scene too. And again there's a heavenly discussion going on. And the discussion this time is, what are we going to do about this wicked King Ahab, who is fit only for destruction? And in the form of the discussion, a spirit, an angelic spirit perhaps, comes and says, I can arrange this, I will see that his prophets are deceived, and he will follow them rather than the prophet of the Lord. Now those three scenes should be enough to give us a fair picture of what the Job scene is about. We have Job with the Satan, or rather we have the sons of God with the Satan in their midst. Job is apparently not there. We have Micaiah in the courts of heaven, and the evil spirit saying that he will teach lies to the prophets of Ahab. And we have the Satan when Joshua the son of Jehozadak is accused before God in the third chapter of the book of Zechariah. Now it seems to me that in all these visions we have a common thing. We have God engaged in discussion with our hosts, with his hosts. We have a decision as to where things shall go. We have then a course of action entered upon. And you can draw two conclusions from this, either of which might be right. And I don't think it's really necessary to decide between them. One of them is that there actually was held an angelic court, and that the sons of God, who later in the book of Job are certainly the angels, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy when the earth was created, and that amongst those angels there was one whose task it was to engage in putting to the test the servants of God and to say what had to be said about their character and see to it that appropriate tests were arranged. So that this one would be the Satan, the adversary, the opponent. Not an evil person at all, but one whose duty it was to engage in testing the servants of God. That's one thought. The other is that because Job is presenting to us something in dramatic form, it has to present it to us by means of a suitable introduction. See, when the book proper opens in chapter 3, there is Job already smitten, stricken, devoid of all his possessions and his property and his health, waiting for a discussion with his friends as to what it all means. And we must have some introduction to tell us how this happened. And chapters 1 and 2, whether we view them as being a picture of an actually heavenly court or not, are chapters which tell us how it happened. They say, Job was perfect and upright. But Job was also wealthy. Job was popular. Job was powerful. And Job was happy. The question to be discussed was Job upright because he was popular, wealthy, happy, and powerful? Or was he upright by nature and would say so if these things left him? If these things left him, would he stay upright? And if so, what explanation would be given of the events that afflicted him? And what lesson can be drawn from that? So, the wealthy, popular, upright, and powerful Job had to be afflicted, and doubtless was. And we have to be given, as an introduction to this dramatic presentation of Job's book, an explanation of how it came about. And the prologue describing the heavenly discussions, and then the afflictions, provides the basis for that. Now, I'll resume that thought in a moment, but as a break for us all, and also to set the scene for the spirit which Job needed to show, let us sing together. We'll sing Anthem 34. Anthem 34, out of the depths have I cried unto thee.
Thank you.
What this comes to, then, is this. Job is an upright and a rich man. Uprightness and riches go very well together. Many of us will be very happy to have both. There are many in the world who are content to have riches however they come. But there was, and to some extent there still is, a widespread philosophy that in some way you get as you deserve. And that parable which I mentioned earlier with the opening words, "There was a certain rich man," which fared sumptuously every day, given to us in the 16th chapter of the Gospel of Luke, is a parable in which the Lord, I believe, takes off the common attitude of the Pharisees of his day, which say, "We are rich, and we are also good. We are rich because we are good. God blesses with present blessings, as well as with future ones, those who trust in him. The children of Abraham who are properly so are those who gain in this life and also gain in the life to come." It's not a doctrine without its truth. There is, of course, in the scripture the statement very distinctly that bodily exercise profiteth for a little while, but godliness hath profit for all things, being profitable for the life which now is, and for that which is to come. But whether this is a picture of present material prosperity followed by future prosperity on a greater scale is not the immediate point of what was said in the New Testament. There is a form of profit both now, in this time, and in the time to come. But the common doctrine was that God would only bless those who deserved it. And similarly, he would only punish those who deserved it. And therefore, if Job was in affliction, he must have deserved it. This, however, is anticipating a little. We go back to the prelude to the book. Rich Job is highly commended in the courts of heaven. He has much goods and much piety. He is powerful. He is also devout. He worships God from his heart, as well as finding that his life is a very profitable one, bringing him great dignity and honour in the sight of others. As a matter of history, this Job, it seems, fell upon deep calamity. He lost his property and his friends and his children and his health, and was for no evident external assignable cause brought to desolation. This is to be made the theme of a dramatic poem. And therefore the dramatic poem commences with a prose prelude in which Job is under discussion in the heavenly courts, and the, as they would say in another kind of court, devil's advocate, or in yet another, the counsel for the prosecution, comes and says, "Job is not as good as he seems to be. He is good because it pays. Doth Job serve God for naught? Thou hast set an hedge about him. Thou hast done this. Everything he does prospers. Why ever should he change?" It's a plausible kind of reasoning. There's a certain element of truth in it whenever the right ingredients apply. Though it isn't invariably true. The whole history of our race stems from a point where God had planted a garden and set a hedge about it and caused it to bring forth fruit trees, and everything they did prospered, and they were only required to abstain from an act of evil. And doth Adam serve God for naught, it might have been said, or Eve either. Look what they get out of it. There's no reason why they shouldn't. Yet the fall stemmed from those circumstances. And the woman was tempted. And the man followed her in falling. The desire to be greater than they were was sufficient to make them sinners when they could very profitably have remained righteous. So, doth Job serve God for naught is not a very sound philosophy to begin with. It is very possible for people to stop serving God because they want their own way, even when, humanly speaking, it might have seemed they run severe risks and grievous perils by doing so. All the same, there are a lot of people who will put up the appearance of serving God when it seems that it pays to do so. And there must be many apparently righteous people who are also quite comfortably off, who see no reason for forsaking the forms of religion, who find it convenient to attend their church, to engage in their public acts of piety, to be seen by people to be religious, because it brings business with it. It helps in the matter of trade. It's a secure membership of a club which, believed to be a club of the righteous, is certainly a club of the mutually beneficial. And it is widely reported that there are arrangements of that kind which exist amongst people who find it convenient to appear to be pillars of the church, that the church might buttress them. Well, it might be so. It could be so in a lesser degree in churches less able to assist those who give them their support. And I suppose in our own midst there is always the possibility that when to serve God brings with it, as it sometimes seems to do, a measure of prosperity, or of popularity, or even, however fleeting it may be, of fame, then to stay in that way is the most satisfactory thing to do. There's no reason seen why one should change, and so one doesn't change. Duh, brother this, or sister that, serve God for naught, it might be said. Everything they do prospers, thou hast set a hedge about them. It obviously pays to be a good Christadelphian. Well now, to that extent, the philosophy has something to be said for it. There is, I have no doubt, in the unworthy minds of all of us, the possibility that a way of life, having once been chosen, could be maintained for reasons that were not the best reasons. And that we could seek to be good and faithful followers of Christ, not so much because following Christ was our first objective, but because it was a convenient way of living the kind of life to drop which would take away from us most of the things we found most precious. So it could possibly be that Satan's statement about Job, "Doth Job fear God for naught," might in principle have had something to be said for it. It was perfectly possible that there could have existed a man, and that man in principle might have been Job, who, finding that serving God brought with it all that was desirable, either didn't let it into his head to change, or if he did let it into his head, pushed it out again, having seen what the disadvantages would be. This might have been so. In which case the legitimate test proposed, take away from him everything that he has had by way of blessing hitherto, was a test that would certainly enable Job to decide how solid his loyalty to God was. Let him make up his mind whether he was going to be faithful for its own sake, or stop being faithful when the benefits stopped. In the event, we discover that when Job lost his wealth, and his family, and his cattle, his declaration was all that heart could desire from him by way of faithfulness. And the words that Job spoke then we will repeat again now. Job chapter 1. Verse 20. Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this Job sinned not, nor charged God with foolishness. To that extent the accuser of Job had failed. Job had come utterly successfully out of his trial. His words, "The Lord hath given, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord," recognize as fully as a man could possibly recognize that it lay in the gift of God to decide what a man should have and for how long he should have it and when and how completely it should be taken away. "God is the arbiter of my life," he said, "and I am content to have it so." And he fell down indeed, but fell down in worship. But then the problem is taken further. Up to that point, Job had everything to lose by failing to serve God. Had lost it and served him still. Now, he's lost much, but not everything. He's lost all the externals, but that which belongs to him as a person is still there. He's in good health, and that has so far been uninjured. So the second divine court is held, and the second probe into Job's character is undertaken. And the Lord said unto Satan, "Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? And still he holdeth fast his integrity, though thou movest me against him to destroy him without cause." And the argument of the Satan at that point is, well, now, Job is balancing probabilities, as it were. He has lost what you had given him by way of blessings. He can't lose that again, and to that extent it might be worthwhile cursing you. But he's still got his health. Skin for skin and bone for bone, all that a man has will he give for his life. So, since he still values his health and still says that's something he owes to you, he will still say faithful to you unless you take that away from him. But take that and he will owe you nothing. And then, you wait and see. Then comes the cursing. Well, that too was a fair line of reasoning. And whereas there are perhaps very few people in life who have ever been in the position of being very rich and have then become very poor, though in good health, who could count their good health the biggest blessings and still go happily through with it, there must be a very great many people in life who are in good health and happy, and although they are very poor, are content to say, well, I would rather be a poor and happy tramp than be a wealthy and sick, rich man, and so I will go through life singing my way on the highways of the world and I shan't care at all. There are plenty of people like that. So, says the tempter, we must test such a person at the point where he is weakest. So we will try Job on that point also and take his health away from him. And so at the end of chapter 2 we are reduced to a situation where Job has nothing left except his life and rather wishes he hadn't got that. Well, there is nothing for Job except to go on living, and where his plea more than once repeated is, I would rather my life was brought to an end, because it's doing me no good. I would prefer to sleep peacefully in the grave than go on living like this. And at that point, we really do have put fundamentally to the test, does a man in that position curse God? If he doesn't, then how does he explain his situation? Do those around him better off than he understand his situation, and how do they understand it? And what will be the outcome? And this matters very much for ourselves. For though some of us have enough to live on, and most of us have our health, there may come a point where we will have to say, the Lord hath given, and the Lord hath taken away. There must come a point where we must say, naked came I into this world, and naked shall I go out of it again, and recognize that all that we have is precarious, and wonder what we would do if it did go. And this is the kind of thing that Job is going to help us to understand.